dummy husbands and dummy landlords and dummy California husbands and wives.
Okay, great. So I want to begin with an apology. I sent this paper as a rough draft to the professor for feedback, and I didn't realize he thought it was good enough to be read. So as you read the paper, you're going to come across a lot of incomplete thoughts and proofreading errors, so I apologize. For those in advance, I do hope that the paper was good enough for you to get a grasp of the general ideas I was talking about. So the purpose of these 10 minutes is to...
Talk about the paper. To people who have read it.
Okay.
After the 10 minutes, well, 5 or 10 minutes of your talking, and then everybody else gets the chance to throw rotten tomatoes at you and tell you how to improve your paper and stuff like that.
So this paper was the reason why I enrolled in this class, because I've been itching to write this paper since I took first year property last spring. I'm currently a 2L last spring. I was a 1L. And one day, Professor Wendell talked about the two-to-transfer rule in property ownership, where if an individual wants to transfer their form of ownership in a piece of land from, let's say, joint tenancy to tenancy in common, they can't do so directly. So, for example, if a wife and husband are co-owners in a property and they want to change the kind of title they have, they can't just say, oh, all right, from today we sign this new title in which we're a different kind of owners. They have to first transfer the property to a straw man who may be a person or a fictitious entity and then take the property back from him in a different form of ownership. So the idea of property... Of this transfer of property from oneself directly to oneself being impossible stuck with me. And I know from my personal knowledge this idea in Islamic law of tahleel marriage, which is when a husband divorces a wife and wants to get remarried to her, he can't just remarry her after divorcing, but the wife has to marry a second husband, get divorced from her, and then only does she become eligible for remarriage to the first husband. Now, and this is actually a Quranic injunction, so pious Muslims will really hold on to this principle very seriously. Now, as my paper indicates, over the centuries, Muslim jurists have been very uncomfortable with the notion of tahleel, the way it took certain forms in medieval Egypt. Actually, you know, tahleel marriage thrived, and actually there was a marketplace for individuals that were willing to be those second husbands for a fee, just so that wives could undergo a second divorce so that they could come back to the first husband. Now, if you delved into, I don't know how else to classify, but pious literature would, of course, claim that the purpose of tahleel marriage was deterrence, so that before a first husband divorced his wife, he would think, oh, really, if I really ever wanted to take her back, we would have to go through so many loopholes for her to come back to me. But, there's the law, and then there's the reality of law, of how it, you know, ends up manifesting itself in people's lives. So I looked at the evolution of tahleel over the years, and I've also looked at how different schools of Islamic thought have approached it. As the professor mentioned, there's the Hanafi school, the Hanbali school, the Shafi'i school. These are different legal schools in Islamic law that interpret, that try to solve problems given within their own paradigm. So, for example, the Hanafi school is more concerned with objective manifestation of intent, whereas the Malikis really care about the intent of the contracting parties and not necessarily how it manifests itself. And so I thought it would be interesting to see how intent has played itself out in these schools of thought and how they understand tahleel marriage. And at the same time, I've looked at the evolution of property transfer in medieval English law and how that has evolved over time, and trying to see if there's any similar trends between how tahleel is treated versus how property transfer is treated over the years in English property law. So it was quite an undertaking. And I think the professor rightly recognized that this paper needs to be pulled together, it needs to be tightened up. And I need to be honest in saying that, you know, sometimes the analogies go only so far, don't go any further. So there's many more hours that have to be put into this paper. but I thought I should mention a few key things in the paper that you've already read, but they're worth, you know, bringing up. This is how my mind worked when I was working on the paper. So English property law, and then the Tahrir law. And for English property law, I thought of, you know, I mentioned one of my opening stories is the story of Franciscan friars needing to own land in medieval English times, but the fact that they were vowed to poverty. So they could not own property. So what their supporters would do was transfer land in their name, not in the name of a third party, with the understanding that the benefit of the land would go to the Franciscan friars. So, and hence my title, Dummy Husbands of Cairo and Dummy Landowners of London. So they were both, the husbands in Cairo and the landowners in London, were sort of these dummy entities that were either going to marry a wife or own a piece of land for the benefit of someone else. So in English property law, the relevant terms would be enfiafi. This is something I had to learn for myself. Enfiafi would be the person who would receive land for the benefit of the friar. Then there's this concept of straw man that I've already mentioned. Even that itself has medieval roots. The straw man was historically a person who would be present in English courts with straw stuffed into his shoes, literally, and they were willing to be witnesses in turn for a price, you know, a sum of money, and willing to go into court and swear to whatever their client was willing to pay them for.
So what is the connection between that and your straw man here? That was one of the things I'd wondered about. Because they were engaged in selling perjury.
Straw men were.
The people with the straw in their feet, in their boots, as you described it, right?
And then Fiafis were willing to hold land while in name only, just because they was going to, you know, their patron asked them to. They said, yeah, we'll own it, but they weren't going to exercise any of the responsibilities or receive or be responsible for any of the...
Wasn't the Enfiafi responsible for responsibilities even though he didn't get the income?
No.
I thought he was the nominal owner, no?
He was the nominal owner. Over the years, Enfiafi realized that he could derive a lot of benefits.
But putting that aside, suppose the land came with the obligation to pay some money to the king in some situation, for example, scutage or something, wouldn't the Enfiafi still have that obligation? The Franciscans wouldn't, but...
Right, so I'm assuming
he's on paper the owner.
That the patron would be paying it. The Enfiafi would probably not.
The patron isn't obligated to pay it, is he? He doesn't have it anymore.
True. But I'm assuming that if the patron wants the Franciscan friars to continue to receive the benefit, he would have interest in paying whatever taxes were due.
As part of what's not clear to me and part of the discussion is the line, and this is also an issue which is going to come up in a later paper as well, the line between things that are enforceable in law and things that are enforceable in conscience. That is, that it sort of sounded as though you were saying that the obligation to let the Franciscans use the property was not enforceable in law.
It was not enforceable. No, you could only spiritually blackmail them.
But then you're saying it's also the case. Is it also the case that the obligation of the donor to pay the taxes is not enforceable in law? That the Enfiafi is the person who is in law obligated for any taxes. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I haven't researched that, but I'm going to assume that that's.
I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah. Conclusion. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, because it wasn't at all clear what those relations were, and when you talked about things changing over time, you never really explained how they changed.
From Enfiafi to strawman?
When you said that over time, Parliament in various ways modified these procedures, and I couldn't figure out what they modified, in what sense they made it harder or easier, or whether they made things binding in law that were before binding only in conscience.
I think, yeah, there was an act of parliament that I referred to, and I think that's what they do in there.
What did it do?
I think they make the individual, so in my paper I talk about how they become responsible for, how they realize that there's benefit to being an Enfiafi, such as now they can, they can transfer land from individual to individual without having to pay taxes to the feudal landlord. So I'm assuming that in that they do take on the financial responsibility that comes with owning the land.
All right, I still don't understand it, but keep going.
Okay. So, and then, And we see that the straw man until early 20th century California in case law, the straw man is there, and eventually someone in the 1950s or 1960s, some court decides to abolish the straw man. Another version of holding property in the name of someone else has taken on the form of the modern trust. And that is, you know, unlike the straw man, who's looked upon derisively, the modern trust is looked upon as a very useful institution for holding property for the benefit of someone else. On this side, I look at the Hanafi understanding of tahlil, which is which really doesn't care about the intent of the
party. Here are a couple more. That isn't working.
Thank you. So the Hanafi arrangement. And the second marriage, the second husband, if he charges a fee, the second marriage contract is valid. If the second husband is if the second husband is insane or a minor, the marriage is still considered to be valid.
What if there is a explicit term in the contract by which he agrees to give up the wife?
In which he agrees to give up the wife, then it becomes invalid.
Uh-huh.
And then the Hanbalis are just outright suspicious of the entire institution of tahleem. So this is just fraught with danger, corruption in society. Nobody should be contracting tahleem marriages. And the primary Hanbali exegete jurist is Ibn Taymiyyah. And he pretty much lives around the same time that the Mamluks in Cairo are contracting tahleem marriages for divorce oath purposes. Divorce oaths are where a man, in order to fortify his promise or commitment, says, I will not kill my enemy, or if I do, may I be divorced. So the woman has nothing to do with this, but his wife has nothing to do with this claim of not killing his enemy or chopping his enemy's head off, but it's his way of saying, I'm going to, you know, give up dominion over my wife because I want to stay true to my word, and I'm going to strengthen my promise. So because there were so many divorce oaths that individuals made, at some point, even just to before they testified in court, they were, you know, expected to articulate divorce oaths. The industry of the second husband or demi-husband thrived. So the more individuals were willing to proclaim divorce oaths, the more demi-husbands were found in Cairo, in medieval Cairo, as a result of which the Hanbalis, Ibn Taymiyyah, became all the more suspicious of the institution of tahleel.
Was it his view that it was not legally valid or only that it was not morally valid?
Morally. So
in his view, if you went through it, were you then legally remarried to the first husband?
If you went through it, were you legally remarried?
Your husband divorces you by a triple divorce.
Yeah.
Somebody then marries you with the unstated but understood intention on the part of all three of you that as soon as he's married you and consummated the marriage, he's going to divorce you.
Yeah.
He does so. You remarry your husband. Is your husband now engaged in illegitimate sex?
I'm not sure.
The reason I'm asking is that I was struck looking at the Shafi'i account of this, which is in Reliance of the Travelers, that they made the explicit point that there were things which were in a sense forbidden but legally binding. That there were contexts in which it was morally wrong to sign a contract, but once signed it was a binding contract. And that was why I was curious whether Taymiyyah was only offering moral objections or he was saying the correct interpretation of the law is no, you are not married.
I'm not sure.
You don't know.
I know. He just presents moral objections. I know that. And then I know that the Malikis have the most emphasis on intent. So in their viewpoint, the marriage is actually not contracted. If either party has the second marriage is not contracted, if either party has the intent of annulling the marriage soon thereafter, just so that the wife could go back to her second husband.
And note that the implication of that is that the remarriage is now a capital offense.
That is correct. The remarriage is a capital offense. The couple is guilty of adultery. And so because of intent being absolutely necessary, I think even though I don't read it anywhere, my understanding is that the Malikis also sort of quell the widespread use of tahlil as a device, as a legal device for remarriage of the initial couple.
Now, what's relevant is that the Maliki doctrine is dominant in Al-Andalus. I believe that's right, isn't it?
That's right.
And the is it Shafi'i at this point that's dominant in Egypt, or do you know?
In modern Egypt?
No, then. In Mamluk Egypt, what's the dominant school? I'm just wondering whether there's any connection between the differing legal school views and the circumstances of the different countries, so to speak, the different regions. Don't know. All right. Yeah.
So you say that the marriage is kind of like a contract in which the father and the new husband are making an agreement, and the new husband actually gets to pay dowry in order to obtain the reproductive organs of the woman or whatever, right?
So when I refer to the father being a contracting party in a marriage contract, I refer to the generic understanding of an Islamic marriage contract in classical jurisprudence. And I'm not necessarily referring to the second husband in a tahlil marriage. I'm even referring to just any marriage.
But it would apply to the second husband as well, wouldn't it?
Not in the way it was
practiced
in Mamluk Egypt, at least.
So who, at the first husband has divorced her.
Yeah.
Isn't it now that in order for her to marry anybody else, she needs her father's permission? So doesn't she return to the father's household?
I think in reality, we see all kinds of things happening. So, for example, my opening story mentions that somehow the first husband was involved in encouraging the first of his wife to marry, but there's no mention as to who legally contracts it. But then there's other incidents in my other stories that I recount in my paper that mentions that a divorced wife would herself take the initiative to marry a slave husband. And I'm assuming in the master-slave relationship, women could take initiative just because there was... You look at me like that.
It seems very puzzling because I think there may be circumstances in Islamic law in which a woman is her own owner, but I don't think that's the usual situation. I don't see the question of whether the person she's marrying is a slave matters.
Maybe after marriage, I don't know, do women become, more...
That's the question. I didn't think so, but I'm not sure. It is certainly true in some societies. In Icelandic society, a woman could be married without her consent by her father's choice for her first marriage, but not thereafter.
Right, so the understanding.
But I don't think that's the case here, but I'm not sure.
There's a distinction between women that are pregnant and women that have had, that have gotten married and have had sex, and
yes.
Thereafter they're considered to be more able to make decisions on their behalf.
Yes.
So they don't, the tahlil or the straw man husband, basically. He's paid now. I mean, he gets paid.
There's no legal limit to the amount of dowry, is there? Isn't that only customary?
I think it's customary, yeah.
So therefore he could give, a one dirham dowry or something, I suppose.
Yeah.
In some cultures, when the dowry is given and the divorce happens, the husband is required to pay back the dowry. Is that the case in long marriage?
The husbands are required to pay back the dowry. When the dowry goes from the husband to the wife at the time of marriage, right? Or the dower?
I think that the dowry is being like a payment to the groom from the wife's family, but I could be given that backwards.
No, what you're talking about though is a payment by the groom to the wife.
That's mahar or dower.
Yeah, that's your dower.
We're talking about dowry, which goes from the wife's family to the husband's family. And I don't know. I wouldn't know about that aspect of Islamic marriage. Yeah.
So can you clarify? Could the wife divorce unilaterally without the second husband's say, consent?
No.
So it seems like there's room for some kind of fraud in that situation where once she gets married, with the expectation of only getting divorced, he wants suddenly more money than they agreed to because she's now stuck.
Which is why I think a lot of women prefer to marry slave men or younger men that were subordinates in some form.
Well, in particular, the slave case, if I understand it, is a neat solution to that problem, because I think a woman cannot be married, cannot be the married to her own slave. I think that, so I think it's the case that marrying your that if your husband becomes your slave, I think that terminates the marriage. So since the slave doesn't get to decide whether he's the slave or not, I think what's going on in what you described is that you marry a slave, somebody else's slave, so it's legal for you to be married to somebody else's slave. He then gives the slave to you. That terminates the marriage without requiring the slave's permission.
Why can't you marry your own slave?
You would have to ask Shafi or your friend Taimiya or some other suitably expert. But I think that's the doctrine. I could be wrong, but I thought it was the doctrine that was one of the things.
I think what's your knowledge?
I could easily be wrong. We can look it up. The stuff's available. But I thought that was what was going on. Okay. But I could easily be wrong.
I knew that adult men could marry slave women.
Yes, that's correct.
But adult women cannot marry slave men.
Cannot marry their own slaves, I think is the rule. I'm not positive, but I think that's the rule. Yeah.
So, your question of fraud, I don't know if there were sort of incidents of fraud.
What were the main purposes of divorce? You said for testifying in court, or what were the main categories that you wrote
out? For divorce oaths per se. So there's tahleel in general, where a husband could, you know, theoretically divorce his wife for any number of reasons, and then they're faced with this issue of, okay, how do I take my wife back? Or she has to go marry a second husband and get divorced from him. But my specific reference to Mamluk Kair, the Mamluk dynasty in medieval Egypt, refers to widespread use of tahleel marriage because of the use of this particular thing called divorce oaths. And in those instances, my understanding is that most of the reasons for declaring divorce oaths were political or social. So, for example, one would say, like I said, there's that reference where I will not chop my enemy's head off, or may I be divorced. Or if you're about to testify in court, or I'm assuming maybe, you know, testifying to the veracity, I don't know, maybe a tradesperson would say, you know, I swear that, you know, the so many pounds of rice that I'm selling you is exactly the amount of rice that I am saying, yeah, I'm giving you.
Like a pinky swear, except it's somebody else.
What's that?
Like pinky swearing somebody, except it's like, oh, somebody else.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so pinky swear is like, oh, pinky swear, or you cut off their pinky.
Yeah.
Never heard of that.
Nobody ever. You've never heard of that?
Never heard of that.
I've heard of it. Yeah.
You heard
it? Yeah. No, but I think I see what she's saying. So, like, you swear by your marriage, and then you can end your marriage, but you can get your marriage right back through Tahleel.
But you can't get it right back.
But you have to let your wife marry someone else.
Not only marry someone else, but consummate the marriage. At which point there may be some question as to whether her next child is yours.
Which is definitely.
That it seems to me that part of what's going on. Part of what's going on in this story is that there is a real cost. There's the cost of the divorce oath is not as high as it pretends to be, but it's not zero. And it's not zero partly because of the point that was raised over there that the Tahleel husband might decide to hold you up for a larger sum than you thought, and partly because men don't want their wives to have slept with other men, and this explicitly she has. I mean, she's got a claim to have done so in order for the process to go through. So those are some costs. And obviously, Taimiya was arguing those aren't high enough. It really ought to be considered something forbidden. And it sounds as though the Maliki position was it is forbidden, that it's not legally effective, if I correctly understand the description.
So does the consummation of the marriage somehow, like, validate the marriage in some way, in background?
Lots of societies. In lots of societies, that's what defines your being married.
Okay. Yeah. I guess that's true. Yeah.
I think it's true in Jewish law as well.
I'm pretty sure in U.S. law, if the male is physically unable to consummate the marriage, then the woman can claim an invalid.
Yeah, I don't know. Has it ever been the case in U.S. law that if a couple get married and before they sleep together, one of them wants to end it, can they back out without any penalty? I don't know.
I think it's voidable.
But if you think about Henry VIII's first marriage. Mm-hmm. Henry VIII marries, I think, a daughter of the King of Spain. and he wants to get out of it. And in the controversy over whether he can get it canceled, he claims the marriage was not consummated. And in fact, at some point, and I think this may be later over the question of legitimacy of Mary, that there is the story that he comes out from the marriage chamber and says to, you know, his attendants, give me a cold drink, for Spain is a hot country and I have been in it. And that was taken as his saying he had had sex with her. And then he was later claiming he hadn't. That was one part of the story. So I'm pretty sure that at least in medieval law, whether the marriage was consummated was important. I'm not sure whether it literally disappeared or only that it was possible to get it annulled if it hadn't been. And I think that's a fairly common attitude. And so, anyway, continue. But remember, we do have a link to Reliance of the Traveler, which is this very long Shafi'i legal text. And you can, assuming that, I've been trying to figure out how to use the web browser on this machine, which I haven't figured out how to do right, so I haven't figured out how to do a search yet, that you ought to be able to call up Reliance of the Traveler, do a search for a word like marriage or slave, and actually look. I mean, that's sort of part of the fun of it, part of the virtue of having the web nowadays. You can actually look at the text and see what it says. And it's quite intriguing sometimes. And in particular, one of the things I did find when looking at it earlier is the Shafi'i position, at least, if I understand it correctly, is that if the Talil husband explicitly agreed in advance to divorce her, it was not valid. But that if he had an intention to do, if all three of them had the intention, but it was never explicitly agreed, it is sinful but valid. That they have acted wrongly and will presumably pay some penalty after death or something, but indeed they're legitimate. Entitled to get remarried.
Jennifer, what was the reason behind needing the second marriage? Why couldn't the first husband just take the wife back? What was the underlying reason for needing the second marriage?
So I tried looking into Quranic exegesis. The primary explanation is deterrence.
Kind of similar to that, what was the husband's motivation to go through this whole process? It seems very expensive and drawn out, and potentially, you know, it could have some serious consequences for it. So they clearly wanted this wife back, and just finding another wife wasn't as appealing. So what was that?
So I think anyone that has any, even the smallest amount of interest in being an observant Muslim believer in the Quran tends to take the Quran for its word and really doesn't question into the practice, into the reason as to an injunction. And this is something that is in the Quran and not even in jurisprudential literature. And because it's rooted in there, individuals haven't struggled with the why of it.
But her question is not why they need the second one, but why they want the wife back at all.
I'm guessing in some cases in the case of Manuel Cairo, it's because they swore the way they swore because they had to alleviate to elevate their social status. Mm-hmm. But then they realized that there's a huge cost involved.
Because the point is that this isn't an ordinary triple divorce, right? The ordinary triple divorce is the case where the husband has really decided he doesn't want the wife, and then he's got to go through this procedure. But this is a case where presumably, you know, he wanted to marry her in the first place. There's no reason to believe he's unhappy with her. It's just that he had to put her up as the stake in order to guarantee something, right? And so he therefore would prefer not to pay, and this is a way in which at some cost he can get out of the payment. I should say my guess, not from Mamluk, but from literature from other times, is that part of what's going on are drunken oaths. That part of what you see happening in some, at least, of the period stories is someone sort of gets drunk and he swears something. Actually, I'm not sure he's drunk, but there's the story about how Ali weighed an elephant, which starts out with an elephant arrives at a port. Nobody's ever seen an elephant before. Isn't this an amazing thing? And one of the bystanders says, if I cannot find out how much the elephant weighs, I am divorced from my wife. Mm-hmm. And I think the implication, partly that was a way of getting his neighbors to try to find out how much the elephant weighs, and they went to Ali, who cleverly figured out how to weigh an elephant, but part of it also was just, you know, I don't know what's the right term, showing off kind of thing, you know, how strongly he meant it. And the story she mentions is a case where you've got somebody who wants his enemy to surrender to him, and so he, what do? You promise not to kill him, and then you kill him. Now you're divorced from your wife, and so in that case he marries his wife to a slave of his and then kills the slave, if I understand the story, and that solves that problem.
So just curious, you said there were like markets for the second husband. So in that sense, it seems like it's a very expensive endeavor. But I guess if you're just marrying to the slave, then it's...
Also, you don't know what the price is.
Not as true.
Well, the slave's owner may charge you, but...
The price is dictated by the Talil husband.
But the price is dictated by a market where there may be more than one Talil husband. After all, it's not as if there's any real cost to him. He's getting to have sex with a woman, possibly attractive woman, once at least.
Right. And, that's why I thought he might have to pay a dowry.
Yeah, and on the other hand, there may be religious objections. That is, if he's been persuaded by Ibn Taymiyyah's arguments, he may say, well, maybe I'm going to go to at least take a longer time getting to heaven because of this. Or some consequence of that sort. So that might affect it. On the other hand, there are surely going to be some people who don't feel that way, and you only need one, and one person can do it multiple times, for that matter, for different wives. One of the references that you made that occurred to me the readers probably wouldn't have followed is the question of Musana, of the people who could be subject to death by stoning, the question of minor versus non-minor and so forth. Is it worth explaining that? Or?
Yeah, sure, to the extent that I understood it for myself. Mohsan and Mohsana are individuals that are liable to death by stoning if they've been in this in a tahrir marriage, which according to most likely under Maliki jurisprudence...
I don't think it's limited to the tahrir marriage. What I think is going on, though I'm not sure, is that unlawful sex, which is a hard offense, has two punishments. It has a punishment of a certain amount of beating if the person involved has not had the opportunity for lawful sex. And it is a capital offense if they have. So I think the situation is that if you are an unmarried woman and have sex with a man you're not married to, that is not a capital offense. Although that's still an offense, obviously. Ditto if you're an unmarried man, unmarried and without a concubine. But if you're a man who either is married or has been married or has had a concubine, then you're violating the rule against unlawful sex is a capital offense, and you're supposed to be stoned to death. I think that's what's going on. I could be wrong.
So, for example,
I'm a Musan and you're a Musana, if I understand that correctly, since we're both married.
Certainly. But, I mean, I would have to explain that in the context of tahrir marriage.
The question is, if what you're doing is unlawful sex, then if you are a minor, you have not had an opportunity for lawful sex in the past, and therefore this unlawful sex is not a capital offense. I think that's what's happening. I'm not certain it is. Does that make sense?
It may be... Well, my understanding would be that it is unlawful sex because
it's unlawful, but it's not capital.
I see.
The point is that whether the same offense, which I'm now blocking on the name of, but the hot offense of first of the list of hot offenses, which is basically having sex with anybody other than your wife or concubine. And that is a capital offense for some people and a serious non-capital offense for others. And I got it correctly, your Musan, Musana, are a man or a woman for whom it would be a capital offense. And then there must be some other term, which I don't know, for those who wouldn't. I'm not sure I've got that right, but I think that's what's happening in what you're describing. It makes sense, at least.
So I felt really limited when I was writing this paper because I don't know Arabic and I don't know Latin. And I felt like I could have done, you know, I was reading a lot of secondary sources and heavily depending on them, and it wasn't fun.
So I guess part of the... Go back a step. One of the things that one sees in the literature, and this is a good deal earlier than the period you're describing, because I'm thinking of literature about al-Rashid, who's about 800 AD, is the idea of clever judges finding ways around things. Mm-hmm. And you have the impression that sort of whenever Rashid got drunk, he would, I don't know if this is historically right, but at least in the stories, he or somebody around him swears to some impossible thing. And, you know, if I can't do A, B, and C, I'll divorce my wife. And then it's up to the clever judge who's at his court to figure out some legal trick by which he can avoid the consequence and do whatever it is. And this feels as though it's sort of part of that whole tradition. As I mentioned earlier, in Somali practice, I was looking that up, and the Somali also swear by my marriage. And if you swear, and I think testimony, if I've got it correctly. So if you swear into a fact by your marriage, fact turns out to be false, you're divorced. Whether you can remarry, I don't know. There's the Muslims, but I don't know to what extent they follow the same rules as the Muslims. It occurred to me that there were two other arguable straw man institutions, one ours and one Muslims, that you didn't cover. And the one for ours is the corporation. Hmm. That a corporation, after all, is a legal person, but not an actual person. Mm-hmm. It's important in our legal system, and it might be worth thinking where it fits in. And the one that I don't think you discussed in Islamic is the waqf, the Islamic equivalent of a trust. Because a waqf was a way in which, in fact, it's very much like your straw man in some sense, because some of the waqfs consist of somebody giving money to a fund which will then support a mosque, mm-hmm. or will support a school, or will maintain a public fountain. So that you have various sort of seen as public-spirited objectives, and you make a donation, and you set it up, and I think it's probably originally under your control, but there's some mechanism for having, as it were, a trustee pass on. Some of the waqfs, however, are much more like our standard trusts in the sense that they're for yourself or your family. So that one of the things you can do, and I don't know enough about the law to know why it was useful, but one of the things you seen being done in accounts of Islamic law, is that you put some money into a waqf, and that money is then supposed to support your descendants. And some rule for who it is who controls it, but he doesn't own it, he can't just spend it any way he likes, and so forth. So again, the waqf seems to be an artificial person.
So I'm thinking, as you mentioned, the one waqf for personal reasons and one for public.
Yeah.
I think the equivalence would be an endowment versus a trust, where a waqf for public purposes for schools and mosques would be similar to an endowment.
Might be, yeah. But I was just—I don't know where to go with it. It just occurred to me that given that you're talking—I mean, I'm just making more work for you—but that given that you're talking about situations in these two legal systems where you have fictitious people, that a corporation is is the elephant in the room. It's the big fictitious person in our legal system.
Right.
And the waqf was a very important fictitious person in the Islamic legal system. That, you know, part of what's, at least if you read the people who believe that the Islamic system was destroyed in the 19th century, one of the things that's happening in the Ottoman Empire is the seizure of the waqfs by the state. And the state says, well, we'll maintain the fountain, but now we got the money. Fountain doesn't go get maintained, tough luck. So all of that seemed to me to sort of fit in with what you were doing. See? Other people have questions and comments?
I was wondering what exactly you meant, or what the difference was between just a normal repudiation or divorce and that irrevocable. Is there like a really big difference in regards to the only the irrevocable?
Yeah, so there is a very clear distinction between a divorce that's revocable and one that's irrevocable. So if and this is again found in Islamic jurisprudence, and maybe in the Quran too, I'm not sure. But when a husband divorces his wife once, there is capacity in that marriage, there's enough tenacity in it for the wife to come back, for the couple to reunite. However, if he divorces three times, then it's considered to be a final divorce, and the only recourse is dahir marriage. So conciliation in one and no conciliation in the other one.
Yeah, I've heard the saying about when you say I divorce you three times, yeah. But so there, when you hear that, it's talking about irrevocable.
Well, okay, so if I was doing a paper on just Islamic marriage law, I'd probably delve into that more deeply. I know that there are differences among jurists. Some would say that three repudiations announced in the same moment count as one repudiation, and then there's others that would say that three repudiations pronounced in one moment do not. Some would say they count as a final reputation. Some would say no, they're just one, and they could potentially be followed by two, or unless reconciliation happens prior to that.
But basically, it's set up so that a single repudiation is not irrevocable. A triple one is, and there's a question as to whether you can do a triple at once or not.
Yeah.
That, I think, is an open question.
You stated much better than
I did. Anyway, but it seemed to me that one of the sort of intriguing things which comes up in this and in a lot of other places is the whole issue of sort of working around the letter of the law. And that if... I mean, I discussed it in one... I had a chapter on the question when God is the legislator. And this is the issue when you have a legal system which you believe you can't change. Now, there's a sense in which you can change it because the schools of law can change their interpretation of the original source material. But at least in theory, they're supposed to do that for scholarly reasons, not because it's been decided that it would be prudent to have a different rule. But you don't have a legislature, basically. And so what can you do is you can find ways of working around the rule. And arguably, there's one of those which I think is currently before the Supreme Court in the U.S., and that's the question of the binding nature of treaties. That I was discussing this with somebody, I think with one of my colleagues recently, and it looks on paper as though all that you need to have a law binding on you is the Senate, the President, and some one foreign power. Because a treaty has to be confirmed by the Senate, not by the House and the Senate. And I gather the current doctrine is that if in the treaty we say we bind ourselves by treaty that we will not permit anybody under 18 to get married, say, to take an imaginary example, that I think is a self-executing treaty. There's some complication as to when you're only saying I'm obliged to pass the law and to when you've just passed it, but that there are circumstances in which it's held that that's self-executing. If so, that means that the Senate and the President and one country willing to sign this treaty with you could pass a law without the House's permission. That's just crazy if you think about the rest of the way our system is set up. We're supposed to take the House and the Senate and either the President or enough to override a veto. And yet that seems to be the case. But that looks like a way in which, in principle, you could walk around, if you imagine it. And we've presently got a situation in which one party controls the House, another party controls the Senate and the White House. And as far as I can tell, the only real constraint that keeps Obama from passing almost any law that he and the senators want is that everybody would be very mad at him because he would be obviously gaming the system, so to speak. I think that's the result. But there are lots of other cases like that. I mean, Jewish law is full of workarounds as well. And have we discussed at any point Islamic, where was I talking about Islamic banking? Maybe it's in one of the papers that we haven't gotten to yet. But in Islamic banking, you're not allowed to collect interest. But if you want to buy a house, I, the bank, am allowed to say, well, here's a $100,000 house. Let us make a contract in which I will buy the house for $100,000 and you will agree to buy it back for me for $150,000, spread out over the next 20 years. All right. Well, that's obviously an interest loan to buy the house, but it doesn't have the form of it. And here, part of the question is, do you modify the law to let people get out of these oaths by somehow getting the law changed, or you do it by gaming it, by taking advantage of the loopholes in the law?
And I think because here God is legislator, people
it's very hard to change it.
Resorted to figuring out loopholes
That's
as
right.
opposed to changing it.
But then the other problem, of course, is do you want to? Because there's a sense in which the whole commitment issue, right? Any commitment after you've made it, you don't want to. That is, after you've been called on it, you don't want to do it. That's sort of the point of, this is the Odysseus tied to the mast story, all right? People are familiar with the story. Odysseus wants to hear the sirens. If you hear the sirens, you'll be so enchanted by their music, you'll jump into the sea and drown going after them. So what does Odysseus do? He has his crew put wax in their ears so they can't hear the sirens, but he, being a hero, wants to hear the sirens, so his crew ties him to the mast. And they then sail past where the sirens are. And he doesn't quite manage to break free. Yeah?
Now, did you say that, I mean, what about Al-Masli and Al-Masursala? I have a source here that talks about how legislation is allowed under Islamic law.
The question is what you mean by legislation. That is, it's clear that de facto the ruler can sort of make police regulations which theoretically are implementing the Islamic law. But the core parts of the law, in particular the Hadith, the Quranic parts of it, are not modifiable at all. And you can fill in gaps, and there are parts of the law where the penalty is up to the judge, where the Hadith all have fixed penalties. I forget the name of it, the Talil or something, whatever it is, the variable penalty one isn't. So you could also appoint judges who oppose very low penalties. But part of the problem also...
Tazir,
that's right. Part of the problem also is if you really believe in this system, which presumably at least some of these people did, then it's God who's going to punish you. Right? That is, the fact that you get stoned to death isn't the real problem. Right? The real problem is whether or not you get to go to heaven. And stoning is sort of a fairly short-term cost, even though most of us would rather not have it happen to us. So in that sense, insofar, one of the things I always find puzzling about all these societies, including ours, is figuring out how much people believe in things. That if you think about, for a moment, Catholic Europe, and we're tempted to say, well, they all really believe in this religion. You say, well, wait a minute. We have people committing mortal sins. If you are told, if you are unfaithful to your wife, you will be tortured for 10,000 years, you would not, and you believed it, you would not be unfaithful to your wife. This is a prediction of human behavior. And yet, you have people doing that or various other things in the same category, even though they nominally believe they'll go to hell for doing it. Now they say, well, maybe I can get forgiven, maybe I can repent, but it's still, I find it hard to believe that you would have as much sin as you do in the world, as it were, in any of these systems, if everybody fully believed in it. This sort of gets to Orwell's, if I quoted Orwell's line somewhere where he says he wants to know how many people, not how many people in England will confess to some vague belief in a supreme being, but how many believe in heaven the way they believe in Australia. And it's a nice way of putting it, because clearly there are people who believe that way. But then, to the rest of us, they seem a little bit weird. I mean, maybe admirable. It's sort of, you know, if you do believe something, you ought to take it seriously. And yet my impression is that I suspect that most societies, most of the time, most of the people didn't believe in heaven the way they believed in Australia. And that arguably one of the reasons for the extraordinary success of Islam was that for a century or two they did. That is, if you think, imagine an alternate history in which in the 1950s a religious leader appears in Mexico, and by this date the Mexicans have conquered all of the U.S. and half the Soviet Union. That's what happens, in effect, because the Arabs are a fourth-rate power. They're not even a single power. They're a bunch of minor states who are at various points sort of allied with the Byzantines or the Persians. The two great powers of that part of the world are the Byzantine Empire and the Sassanid, the Persian Empire. And within the lifetime of people who knew Muhammad, the entire Sassanid Empire is conquered by the Muslims, and they get about half the Byzantine Empire. So, and one explanation, I'm not sure it's right, but one explanation is if your soldiers really believe in heaven, they don't worry about dying, right? That's a real advantage. Not sure that's right, but I think that might be what happened. This is, you know, Ibn Khaldun's exponent. I don't know if I've told you about this. It's a neat bit. Ibn Khaldun is a 14th century North African political scientist. And he has a theory of, a political science theory. And it's a theory with a lot of inertia, it's a cyclical theory, but it's a theory in which each cycle takes a long time because of the inertia in political institutions. But he says, isn't there evidence against this, the initial success of Islam, when overnight practically everything was changed? He says no, because this was a miracle. And scientific theories are not required to account for miracles. Other points, other questions? I guess one other point I wanted to make, because it's one which runs through all legal systems, really, is the distinction between rules and standards. The distinction which is, in a sense, the distinction between the Maliki and the Shafi'i rule here. Do you say, here is the rule, if you check this box and cross the T's and dot the I's and do these things, the law takes effect, just like a computer program, as it were. Or do you say, no, 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 if you do these things honestly, if this has a good reason, you can think of lots of different standards. So that in our context, the rule would be it is illegal to drive more than 70 miles an hour. The standard would be it is illegal to drive in a dangerous fashion. And both of those are wrong, as both of them are wrong in different ways, because the 70 mile an hour standard is too high when it's pouring rain and heavy traffic. It's too low, perhaps, when the highway is empty, it's a nice clean day, and you're getting home. And the other one has the problem of who's going to decide. It's, you know, you think I'm driving dangerously, I don't. And it seems to me that this is a case where you're going, where the Maliki are going by something close to a standard, and that everybody else is going by a rule, if I correctly read this. All right. Any other questions? If not, we get to hear about excommunication, which is not entirely irrelevant to what we've just been talking about. I think the two do connect. You want to tell us about how you get excommunicated, just in case anybody's worried about it?
So, the reason why I wanted to do this paper is because I actually grew up Catholic. And the word excommunication always kind of hung over our heads. I mean, no one really knew what was in the excommunication process, what it actually meant for the Catholic individual. So another reason why I wanted to do this was because there seems to be a progressive trend in the Vatican with the new Pope, Pope Francis. To many, it seems to signal a relaxation with regard to punishment.
Can you define progressive? It's one of those sort of ambiguous words.
More socially progressive. So he has.
Do you mean a trend in directions you approve of?
Well,
if progress just means change, then all change is progressive. And if not, then it seems to me that in order to say it's progressive, you've got to only say he's changing this way, but he ought to.
I guess it's more of a liberalizing trend.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Not necessarily whether I agree with it or not, but it has become more liberal under Pope Francis, or at least it seems that way. So, but to understand excommunication, I think it's useful to know a little bit about the structure of the Catholic Church and the many rights.
Clergy and the laity. The clergy takes up the ordained portion of the church that can be represented like this. You have the priests down here, bishops, archbishops, cardinals, and then. And the Pope. And it's also divided geographically. Okay. We have the diocese, archdiocese, and of course the Holy See. So each diocese has priests, bishops have control over, I think it's. No, the bishops have control over the diocese, all right? And then the archbishops control the archdiocese and the Holy See. Of course, the Vatican has the Pope.
And this is nominally an entirely hierarchical system, I guess, compared to some other Christian groups. That is to say, the priest has no ownership over his... priest has no ownership, the congregation has no ownership. In a certain sense, everything belongs to an organization of which the Pope is the head.
Yes, that's strictly hierarchical.
In that sense, including this building, presumably.
Yeah, actually, it does, because it's a Catholic school. But
the Catholic Church owns this school.
Yeah, okay.
That is, the Jesuit order owns this school, okay. And in some sense, the Catholic Church owns the Jesuit order.
How does the whole Jesuit, Roman, Catholic thing...
But an interesting question, because how do the orders fit into the structure you just told us?
The orders, I believe, go into the laity. We have the various Christian brothers, like the Jesuits.
So the orders include, many of the Jesuits are not laity.
Many of them aren't, but
at what point do they get classified?
So that is to say, does the local bishop have any particular authority over this building, or is it only that the internal hierarchy of the Jesuit order has authority over this building and the Pope has authority over the hierarchy? You don't know.
That I don't
know. I'm just curious because, in a sense, this is a real world, strange legal system that we're sitting on top of. And, yeah. But you think the particular bishop here, that is, you think that the territorial authority division applies to orders such as the Jesuits with regard to, you know?
I went to a Benedictine private Catholic church school, and it was like that the Orden, the Benedictine Orden, they owned the building, but they had like orders from the Pope again. So
from the Pope, yes, but do they have orders from the local bishop? I'm just wondering if the orders are independent of the geographical system or not.
Actually, there was no bishop in this geographical area uh-huh. because there was the orden of the Benedictine.
Uh-huh. So the Benedictines were the Benedictine authorities, okay. were. Yeah. As you may know, the Jesuits got abolished. The Jesuits are one of the few institutions who have risen from the dead. They were abolished by the Pope, I think it was either 18th or 19th century, due to various things, and then came back into existence. Yeah.
And let's not forget their whole ideology taking a 180. They used to be the most hardline conservatives, and now they're regarded as the most liberal left-wing or post-sect in the church.
They clash a lot with the Vatican and social policies. So the church also has a very defined legal system called the Codex Juris Canonici, the canon law from 1980. The one from 1983 is the one that is currently controlling. It has contract law in it, civil rules of evidence. But the one that I focused on is what's the thing with the criminal system here. And there are two kinds of penalties: the expiatory penalties and censures. And excommunication falls under the censures. Those are called medicinal penalties. The point of a medicinal penalty is to get the wrongdoer to reform his or her ways. So excommunication is also probably the most misunderstood penalty under Catholicism. A lot of people think it's kind of like the Amish mitum, where the person is ostracized from the community. It used to be that way, but it's not anymore. So excommunication may or may not require the perpetrator to stand the trial, which kind of runs contrary to what we think as a due process. So in a lot of situations, the perpetrator is left to self-enforce. So there are some key terms.
Well, it's hard to say because if you are excommunicated, presumably have committed a crime, or Catholic Church calls it the zealot. And if you meet four requirements, then you are supposed to excommunicate yourself. And it's not known to the general public whether or not you're.
Think about the analogy for a moment of Marame among the gypsies. All right, there are really two different ways you can get Marame. Pollution. One of them is you do something that pollutes you. All right, and there is this elaborate system. The other is that a Chris Romani is held over some dispute you're a part of, and they say, pay the other guy $20 if you owe it to him, and you don't, and they say, all right, you're now Marame. So as far as I can tell, if I understand it correctly, it's sort of a spiritual condition, which might or might not be imposed by some action by someone outside, and might, again, going back to what I was saying about Islamic law, ultimately the enforcer is God. So if somebody says to you, honestly and correctly. Having done that, unless you do X, Y, and Z, you're going to burn in hell. That's pretty good reason to do X, Y, and Z if you believe him. And it doesn't require that there have been any legal procedure to condemn you to burn in hell. God's got control of where you go, after all. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think so. Well, those are the four elements of culpability for excommunication. The first one is you have to be at the age of authority, and you have to be at least 16 years old. The second, you have to possess the full use of reason. The third is sufficient moral liberty. And the fourth is knowledge of the law and the penalty. So, and these are all elements of the term, they're not factors. So you have to meet all four of those. So just like our criminal justice system, they have the reasonable person standards. And they both consider a sufficient act of freedom.
Are there also exceptions for willful ignorance?
The second element. So whether the person acted freely is absolutely relevant. So under our criminal justice system, we consider whether the person was under duress or was acting under self-defense or necessity, and so does the Catholic Church.
So what's the Catholic Church's position on committing a mortal sin when you would get killed if you didn't?
I don't know, but I assume that the punishment would have been lowered.
Is there any punishment? That is my impression is at least some...
Right.
I think some views in both Jewish and Islamic law, as I understand it, hold that you can do things you normally aren't permitted to do. I'm pretty sure that it's legitimate to eat food that is haram if you would starve if you didn't. I think I'm pretty sure I've seen that statement somewhere.
Yeah, there was a news article about it done. I think she was in Ireland. She got excommunicated because she was working at a hospital and she assisted in an abortion, but there was an element of necessity there. So she was able to. She got her excommunication at first. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
But, that's one example.
Yeah.
Very basic question. How do you get. What is the process of which one is declared excommunicated?
Literally, you commit the act, and if you know that the act is against Catholic teaching, then you are excommunicated.
That's one of the methods. You've also described the other one.
Yeah, there's also the forenda. The forenda, where you actually stand a trap. You get notice from the Vatican that you have committed a delict against the Catholic faith. And in certain situations, they will actually excommunicate you. And that happened very recently. I think it was back in September. A priest in Australia was advocating for the ordination of women to the priesthood. And he was also performing things like marriages on the steps of Carlton. And he got a letter from the Holy See telling him that he had been excommunicated by Pope Francis. But it didn't really say why. But I think it was pretty obvious why.
Do ordinary Catholics, everyday people get excommunicated, or is it something that sort of want people who do the utmost?
Under the second type of excommunication, theoretically they can. For example, there was a code penalizing a Catholic who joined the Freemasons. So if you join the Freemasons, then there would be this whole process where you would go through.
And was that one which required a legal process, or did you just know you were excommunicated once you'd done it?
That one required a legal process. So if you look at the canon law, some of the criminal statutes have this phrase called, that the individual is to be punished with a just sentence. So if you see that, it usually signifies the excommunication of that second type. But if you obtain an abortion, belongs to that first group. Go ahead.
May I ask a question? For, because I think also, which is interesting about that, is when it comes to suicide, it's also, I read your paper, and I think it's like, you get, do you, I don't know if you maybe know it, do you get excommunicated
designated after, before the funeral, because you don't get them messed.
Traditionally, suicides were not buried in funeral grounds. It was a rule. And whether that counts as excommunication, I have no idea.
I should backtrack a little bit, because there are some rights and responsibilities for an Catholic. And excommunication has an implication for each of them. One of them is called, the Latin word I think is called crypta, which is when you are the rite of burial. If you have been excommunicated or you're manifestly persevering in a grave sin at the time of your death and you don't repent for those sins, you cannot be buried with other Catholics. And if you do, you're definitely retired. So
just to make sure I understand this correctly, the first one, latte sententia, if I know it's a mortal sin, I commit that mortal sin knowing that I am excommunicated by God, just in my own.
Right. Yeah, and it's weird, isn't it? Because
if I take communion after not having confessed or something like that.
Right, because it seems really counterintuitive to someone who's studying American law, where the main foundation of our entire legal system is to process and notice.
Take the question, for example, of whether Obama ought to put himself in prison.
Right.
Because Obama has confessed to having smoked marijuana. Smoking marijuana is illegal. Right. Obama has not proposed changing that law. So from this point of view, Obama should at some point, maybe before he ran for president or maybe after he gets out of the White House, simply volunteer for a suitable prison sentence. And that would be the equivalent of this position. Similarly, the mayor of Toronto, I guess, would say he smoked crack.
It was very, very inebriated.
Yes, someone's comment on it was that there was something wrong with the society. We're more worried about the fact that he briefly smoked crack than about the fact that he routinely got drunk. Which is why he smoked crack, by his account of it. But that's a separate issue. But I'm curious for a moment. Suppose that I excommunicate myself on the first basis. And the question is, what are the consequences? That is, presumably, one consequence is not that I can't get buried in hallowed ground because nobody else knows. But if I am buried in hallowed ground, now has the graveyard been desecrated?
Well, there are a lot of... there's 7 different sacraments in the Catholic Church. There's baptism, confirmation, Eucharist, and I think when you get married.
But I get, am I any more in trouble with God if having been excommunicated, I then do things that excommunicated people aren't supposed to do?
I think that's really Catholic. I think so, yeah. Because it's not just the burial issue, there's also different.
I shouldn't take communion, for example.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm curious about the enforcement mechanism that works. If you think about the whole question of one's relationship to God, there are really 2 ways you can look at it. One of them is God tells me what is right and I ought to do the right. Another is God is capable of punishing me for disobeying him and is prudent, therefore, to obey him. And on the former method, it would make sense that all we have to do is say, having done this, you're excommunicated. And now, realizing that you ought to do right things, you won't take it. An alternative version would be to say, you're excommunicated. That means that taking communion is going to be a sin. But if that doesn't increase the penalty anymore, why should you care? You know, it's like a point I made in the law and econ context when I was raising the question of your legal system has a maximum penalty of life imprisonment. And someone proposes that armed robbery is a very serious offense, so you ought to get life in prison for armed robbery. And the economist replies, you really want armed robbery to routinely murder their victims. Because the additional penalty for murder is now 0, and he can't identify you if he's dead. And so I'm sort of curious to what extent increasing in the case of belief, which a whole lot of very smart people tell us about, is the first view of it, which is the reason you because God has told you what's right, or the second version, which is certainly what people often parody religions, which is you're doing it all, so it's not the burden now.
I think it's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. Having grown up Catholic, you have that phrase called Catholic guilt. So we have that figure of what's going to happen in the afterlife, too. And of course, all the action of judgment that my paper talks about how to understand yourself. And depending on the underlying crime or zealot, for example, if you obtain an abortion, you have to get the excommunication reversed by confessing the sin to a person. Most of the time you can get the excommunication reversed by speaking to anyone in the clergy, but there are some...
When you say you can, you mean that speaking does it, or that they have the power to cancel it?
They have the power to cancel it.
But they might say, having heard you talk about it, I don't believe you really are repentant.
Absolutely, yeah, because there are also elements for a successful confession. Absolution of the penitent and the so you go into the confessional booth and you confess your sins to the priest, and then they tell you that you go say 10 Hail Marys or
something. So there's a sense in which the version that sees it as penalty looks as though it's got a gaping loophole. That you can be as sinful as you like, just as long as you make sure that the day before you die, you go into confession and get forgiven.
Yeah.
And
unless they give you so many Hail Marys that you can't say them all before you
die. Yeah. And I mean, like, the canon law actually provides that the priest or the clergy who's being confessed to have the discretion to grant the...
So the higher the offense, the higher level of clergy
generally,
have
yeah.
to confess to.
And there is an exception. If the penitent is about to die, then he can confess to anybody, including a priest who is the excommunicated.
Yeah. So. But presumably, in principle, if you believe in it as a system of punishment rather than a system of moral obligation, you ought to be worried that you will be unable to repent. That is to say, you're on your deathbed, and the priest says, do you repent for your sins? And you say, yes, and you know you're lying. And therefore, you're going to get punishment in spite of it. So that might be, as if you think of it, sort of two different ways of looking at how a religion gets people to do things. One of which is they really believe that, you know, the same reason you do things because other people will give you good advice, or versus punishment. And it does depend on whether people can or can't guarantee to repent on demand.
Like Pascal's wager.
Yeah, that kind of problem.
And the paper also talks about how excommunication was effective before the 1980s.
King John, rather earlier than that.
King John.
We talked about before or after she was clean.
How
could she be forced to relinquish anything? The Catholic Church no longer had any power in England at that time.
Yeah, I know. That's why I was a little confused about.
So I'm not sure I understand.
Right under the Telfers, where they told, basically, you know, Elizabeth II that
second or first?
The first.
They told her what?
That she had no legal authority over her own kingdom, which I guess had no real effect. Since
the only effect would be that believing Catholics in England would feel to be able to today, but that was
like Henry VIII.
Had already taken it out.
But
in the case of King John, it seems to me it's a more interesting case, because King John is excommunicated at a point when he is a Catholic, but England is Catholic, and this is one of the factors in the baronial revolt against him, which was doing pretty well at the point when he died. I don't know if you'll realize that when King John died, there was a French army in London, headed by the heir to the French throne, King Dauphin. Anyway, I think we'll finish on time, and please do read the Ptolemaic paper for next time, and I will find something else to add to that. sometime tonight or tomorrow.
I was confused because I was reading here, it's Quran and the Hadith assume.